Today, the frailty we bring to our frailty.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I know that sounds like doublespeak. Promise it's not just cutesy. It is reflective of two ideas that I'm hoping to arrive at today. Using a particular part of history that we've talked about before, which I'll get to in a moment. But what I mean by that, the frailty we bring to our frailty, is first that we're not very good at recognizing our frailty. In particular, I mean it this way. We don't recognize in ourselves the frailties that seem so obvious in others. We're pretty good at spotting everyone else's weaknesses, but not so good at spotting ours, which is itself a frailty, right? That's one of our weaknesses. And so I mean by that, the frailty we bring to our frailty, that we're frail about recognizing our frailties. And then secondly, that whenever we do recognize the frailty in ourselves, we often, in recognizing it, sort of give up any idea that we actually have a strength. So when we recognize the frailty in ourselves, we abandon the strength that allowed us to see that frailty. We abandon the gift. In some cases, it's a gift that God has given us to be able to see that frailty, or the power that we have that allows us to see that frailty. And by doing that, we sort of compromise the whole value of having recognized our frailty. It's sort of like recognizing a disease in a tree and then just giving the tree to the disease instead of actually treating it and so on. So that's what I want us to do, is just consider the frailty we bring to our own frailty today. And I want to use Adolf Eichmann. Again, I choose him not because of him. It's because of Hannah Arendt. So yes, I'm a fan of Hannah Arendt. I'm a fan boy, as some people would say, to make fun of me. I wish everybody would pick up Hannah Arendt and read her at this particular time in our history again, because she's so good at pointing out the very things that we're falling prey to right now, and that the world fell prey to, the Western world, in the decades that led up to World War II and all the consequences that went with that, and some of the precedents that went with that as well. And so anyway, in looking at some material with some of my students in a class I'm teaching right now in political theory at Criswell College, where I serve, and I enjoy being the president, blessed to be the president, in a class that I had with some of my students in that class, they had read a particular chapter, the eighth chapter in Hannah Arendt's book that we talked about before on a different episode regarding Adolf Eichmann's trial. And the eighth chapter in particular is important because it's where it talks about some of Eichmann's humanity at the highest level, meaning a big part of that book that Hannah Arendt writes that leads to the phrase that people use, sort of a subtitle to the book, The Banality of Evil. Eichmann in Jerusalem is the title of the work. One of the primary focuses of that work is to unveil Eichmann as a human being, not to defend him. And it's just funny, ironic, that Hannah Arendt ends up being attacked for saying these things as if she's defending Eichmann, which is the last thing in the world she's doing. If you read the book if you just read the book, you know that's not what she's doing at all. She is absolutely advocating against everything about a person like Eichmann. Her point is that we're all like Eichmann in some ways, and that we all have to exercise a caution lest we become guilty of exactly the same kinds of things. And lo and behold, that's why I think it would be such a relevant read for people today. And not just that one, but all of her books. And we've talked about two or three of her books in different episodes on this podcast. So I hope that you have picked her up and read her by now. But if you haven't, do it when you have the opportunity. And she's a great writer, very easy to read. Again, you know, this is writing from the mid-20th century, and it should be dated, and it is in some of the vocabulary, meaning some of the references to people, but aside from that, it's not dated at all. You'll feel like she was writing it now, as if retrospectively. So anyway, back to the point. Talking about Eichmann, using him as a historical figure to talk about the frailty we bring to our own frailty gives us a good point of examination, precisely because he's so human and because he's so disgusting. I mean, he headed in many ways and was maybe the most faithful, ardent advocate of the final solution, the genocide against the Jews in Europe. He was an evil perpetrator of the worst possible kind, and yet just like us in so many ways. So he's a perfect case study for this. And so what happened in the trial, I'm sure you've watched a movie or read a history about the kidnapping of Eichmann from, I think it's Argentina, and taking him to Israel, to Jerusalem, to be tried, and then the result of that, his hanging. And if you haven't, you should. It's a fascinating story. It's a mind-blowing spy, you know, sort of espionage thriller that you wouldn't believe is true, except that it's exactly how it happened. It's just mind-bending. Anyway, when all that's done, what you end up with is this man on trial, not for the general genocide of the Jews, as we've talked about before, but his own crimes against them. But it was his crimes against the Jews, his perpetrations, his acts against the Jews that was on trial. And so what ends up being on trial are his motives, because what he wants to say and what people are watching for is to find out why on earth a person would do such a thing. That's how the world is watching the trial or listening to the trial. And Hannah Arendt, as she's recording it, is saying, and so people think there are only a couple of ways to explain why he would do this. I mean, he must have been motivated by something radical. And so I'll read this quotation from that chapter. It says that Eichmann had at all times done his best to make the final solution final, was therefore not in dispute. All of that is pointing back to the fact that, you know, people like Himmler and others were backing off of the genocide when they realized the Germans were losing the war. By the way, that's how pragmatic this is. And by the way, even in backing off from the genocide, again, you've got to read these books, but even in backing off of the genocide, all it meant was they started looking at countries that were hoping to rescue Jews and saying to them, well, for $2,000 a head, we'll be willing to send them to you. And trying to make millions of dollars, in our terms, off of the genocide. So anyway, that was the weakening of the final solution. Eichmann was dismayed that people were undermining the Führer's wishes, and he was clinging to this desperate loyalty to the actual murder of these people. And so now I'm back to quoting. It says that Eichmann had at all times done his best to make the final solution final was therefore not in dispute. The question was only whether this was indeed proof of his fanaticism, his boundless hatred of the Jews, and then whether he had lied to the police and committed perjury in court when he claimed he had always obeyed orders. In other words, Eichmann's defense was to say, I was just obeying orders, right? We've heard this defense. And we'd heard it before. And their attack on him in their minds was to say, you aren't just obeying orders. You yourself hated the Jews. And because that was your motive, that's why you need to be judged. I'm not saying the judges in this trial were doing that. I'm saying that was a public sentiment about it. And sometimes you can tell Hannah Arendt, as she writes about this, admires the judges in a lot of ways and not necessarily the prosecutors. In the way that they execute things. But again, she's not hypercritical, but you can tell in some of the comments she makes that may have been what was going on. Anyway, my point there is that the trial's revealing the motivations of this guy, Eichmann, and trying to get at why he would do it. Could a person legitimately really just say, yeah, I orchestrated the execution of millions of people because, I had an order and I had to obey my order. Is that really enough to justify his actions and then for us to punish him for those actions when he was just obeying orders? Or can we say, no, you yourself, you hated them. You were the one who did it. And that would make it easier for us to execute him. The thing is that as you go further into the trial and you hear his testimony, and you would think, well, you don't have to believe him. I mean, he's just lying to save his own skin. But a lot of his testimony isn't that at all. And the defenses that he gives are so absurd. They're not defenses at all. They sound more like confessions, that you realize something's wrong in the way he's thinking, but you know there's nothing wrong with him intellectually. There's nothing wrong with him in terms of normal social polity. He knows how to get along with people. So something's up that he's sitting on and saying things like this. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. So the motivations that he reveals create this problem that extends itself beyond Eichmann in our way of thinking about other people. It extends itself to other Germans during the war, which is his defense based on obeying an order. So in Jerusalem, confronted with documentary proof, this is Arendt's words, Hannah Arendt, I'm quoting, in Jerusalem, confronted with documentary proof of his extraordinary loyalty to Hitler and the Führer's order, I was just describing that a moment ago, even when others were compromising, he was adamantly saying, we must carry this out to the final moment, right? So that's who Eichmann became. So they had documentary proof of that. He had written memos saying, we're going to continue to do this no matter what. So with all that evidence, Eichmann tried a number of times to explain that during the Third Reich, and now we have a translated quotation from him, the Führer's words had the force of law. And now we're outside the quotation marks from Eichmann. This is Arendt again. Which meant, among other things, that if the order came directly from Hitler, it did not have to be in writing. Now, Hannah Arendt has this depth of analysis that goes on to talk about the law and where the laws have to be written and a person just saying the words and so on. But in Germany, it's true that she acknowledges that Adolf Hitler, whatever he said, is what people had to do. And it had such a force to it that no matter what else there was to be reconciled with it, if it contradicted what Hitler had said, then it was illegal. And if its behaviors didn't follow what Hitler said, then it was illegal. That's how things worked in Germany under Hitler. It's part of what it means to be totalitarian. And so in acknowledging that, what she's pointing out is that millions of Jews were just, I mean, Jews, millions of Germans were simply following orders. So they were, and that was going to war and fighting against U.S. soldiers as well. And in taking their little bureaucratic part or their mechanistic part in the slaughter, the genocide, the Shoah, against the Jewish people. And so, and again, this makes it, all this does is make it a challenge. It doesn't mean, oh, well, they were okay then. It was all Hitler's fault. It wasn't their fault. That's not what this says at all. That's why some people didn't like what she was saying. They never worked their way to the end of the point. And I'm not making her exact point today, but it's a parallel point. It goes in the same direction. So anyway, the first part of this is that a lot of Germans had to confront this reality that they were commanded by the law of their land to do something that all of us look at now and say, they should have known was wrong. They should have known not to do it. In fact, it's so wrong, they should have been willing to die in order to avoid doing it. That's how wrong and obviously wrong it seems to us their kind of behavior was in obeying that law of the land. And so part of what comes out of this is the importance of distinguishing between a law of the land and some law that might be more universal than the law of that land. Something that would give, for instance, in the way we talk about the military now, something that would give a soldier justification in saying to his commanding officer, I can't obey that command. I cannot obey that order, and yet not be court-martialed for their disobedience. I don't know if I used all the technical words right there. I'm not in the military, haven't been. I don't understand exactly what a court-martial is in opposition to some other kind of prosecution. I don't know. So work with me and just kind of give me a pass on that one if you don't mind. Don't court-martial me over my use of the word court-martial. Here's my point, that you do have to learn to distinguish between the two if you're going to make moral judgments about the law of the land in any way. And so Hannah Arendt goes on to say this: Eichmann's position, therefore, showed a most unpleasant resemblance to what I just mentioned, to that of the often-cited soldier who, acting in a normal legal framework, refuses to carry out orders that run counter to his ordinary experience of lawfulness, and hence can be recognized by him as criminal. The extensive literature on the subject usually supports its case with the common equivocal, meaning it can reflect both the law of the land. So we're talking about the equivocation on the word law. It could refer to the law of the land, or it could refer to this more universal law. So here's how she says it. It supports its case with the common equivocal meaning of the word law, which in this context means sometimes the law of the land, that is positive law, meaning laws that have to be posed and put out into society, and sometimes it means the law that supposedly speaks in all men's hearts with an identical voice. Now, obviously, if that were the case, if that law spoke in all men's hearts with an identical voice, then no one would ever wonder, which they were supposed to do. They would just be making a choice between evil and good. But it's not quite that simple, you know, and that becomes apparent in the way Eichmann justifies his behaviors beyond this, which I'll come back to in a little bit. We'll talk about it in ethical terms in just a moment. But the first part of this it's a challenge, is recognizing that, let me redeem this for just a moment from the idea that you might have that I'm trying to say we should just understand Adolf Eichmann better. If we just understood him, we wouldn't have hanged him in the streets of Jerusalem. I'm not saying that at all. Nothing to do with capital punishment or not. This has nothing to do with giving any moral ground at all to Adolf Eichmann. I'm giving him none. He deserves none. But that doesn't mean there's nothing there but some dehumanized monster that we can treat in the way we talk about beasts or machines who do these things, which is the way we talk about enemies, as if they're not human beings anymore. And that's false. They are human beings. That's what makes them so formidable. And I mean morally formidable, not in the moment or the crisis, but for moral examination. It's why we're so angry with them. It's why we like to dehumanize them in the language we use about them. But it's not true and not right for us to do that. And so I want to point out along the way that nothing I'm saying undermines our ability, our ability to recognize Adolf Eichmann as a human being, who it would be worthwhile to understand as a human being, doesn't in any way undermine our ability finally to say, and yet what he did was inexcusable, and just can't be done. And so let me point it out with this quotation in that chapter from Arendt. She says, no other explanation ever occurred to the judges. This is going back to, remember, it's either his radicalism, he hated those Jews, or it's, I'm just totally obedient to the law that was given to me and I had no harm intended. I was just trying to obey the law of the land. No other explanation ever occurred to the judges, who tried so hard to understand the accused. And this is fascinating. And treated him with a consideration and an authentic, shining humanity, such as he had probably never encountered before in his whole life. And then there's a parenthetical note that I'll repeat for you at the end of this episode. It says, Dr. Wechtenbruck told reporters, I don't know who Dr. Wechtenbruck was, that Eichmann had great confidence in Judge Landau. Now, this is the presiding judge. I do know who he is. As though Landau would be able to sort things out. This is how Eichmann thought of the judge in the trial in Jerusalem, because Landau treated him so respectfully. He made sure that other people treated him respectfully. He provided a place where he couldn't be assassinated. He spoke directly to him. There were often in German. So he respected Landau. Eichmann believed Landau would calm the crowd and make things right, sort it all out, and he would be somehow given a soft landing, right? And so it says, he believes Landau would be able to sort things out, so I'm quoting Arendt again, and ascribed this confidence to Eichmann's need for authority, that he looked to Landau now as his new authority, you know, just as he had looked to Hitler. Well, that man does that. I'll follow him no matter what. Oh, well, this man's the judge. He'll surely make things right, and he's treating me like a human being, so he understands how we function together, right? So his confidence is built on his need for authority. Whatever its basis, though, she goes on to say, the confidence was apparent throughout the trial, and it may have been the reason the judgment, which was against him and that he would be hanged, caused Eichmann such great disappointment. He had mistaken humanity for softness. That's an important distinction because empathy is an essential part of humanity. The mercy that comes with empathy is an inherent part of humanity. It's an essential part of humanity. If you lose empathy, you lose a footing in humanity. But that reality doesn't change that it's not the only part of humanity. And some of the other parts are good and some of the other parts are bad, but it's not the only part. And so anyway, so as we're reading through this, what happens, and this is the most telling part of the sort of, the idea that people could equivocate and say, well, Eichmann was doing what he believed was right. And the fact that we won the war doesn't mean we have a right to judge him. How you always say the victors, they write the history. Well, that's true. They do. It doesn't mean the history they write is correct. And so that point sort of gets really muddled in this discussion about Kant, except that Arendt is just so good at always reinserting the reality of what's going on. So the most telling example of Eichmann trying to protect his own position and explain that he was acting in good conscience is his appeal to Immanuel Kant, who we've talked about on other episodes in the show, and who you in this podcast, and who you would recognize maybe this way as a philosophical form of the golden rule: do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's what it ultimately comes down to: the categorical imperative. Whatever rule you have for anybody, you have to have for yourself, and vice versa. Right. So the rules apply to everyone equally. That's the idea. So I'm quoting Arendt again now. Whatever Kant's role in the formation of the little man's mentality in Germany may have been, that is, hey, I was nobody. I was just following orders. That's the little man's mentality she's talking about. There is not the slightest doubt that in one respect, Eichmann did indeed follow Kant's categorical imperative precepts. A law was a law, and there could be no exceptions. And you see, the law in this case is the Jews must be exterminated. The final solution must be executed. So there could be no exceptions. In Jerusalem, he admitted only two such exceptions. Listen, now, this is we're at the nadir of the discussion, or the pinnacle of the point. But it's the nadir of the discussion, though. This, in all the things that Adolf Eichmann did, in all the people that he executed, this is what he feels guilty about. And I've mentioned this on a different episode in passing. This is how it reads. So she says this. In Jerusalem, he admitted only two such exceptions to following Kant's categorical imperative, that is, to violating his duty, to do what is right. He admitted to only two such exceptions during the time when 80 million Germans had each had his decent Jew. That meaning people would sneak somebody out. And so she goes on. He had helped a half-Jewish cousin. This is Eichmann. He had helped a half-Jewish cousin and a Jewish couple in Vienna for whom his uncle had intervened. This inconsistency still made him feel somewhat uncomfortable. A man who had orchestrated the slaughter of millions of Jews felt a little uncomfortable about only two things: letting his half-Jewish cousin off and helping this Jewish couple from Vienna out of the country. This inconsistency still made him feel somewhat uncomfortable. And when he was questioned about it during cross-examination, he became openly apologetic. He said he had confessed his sins to his superiors. He had apologized for only one thing, not following the order to kill as many Jews as he could possibly kill. Now, that's as condemnatory. I'd say it's a paradox, but it is comprehensible. We can understand this. But this is that ironic moment. If we were in a story, a fairy tale, this is that tension that makes it impossible to miss this most important point if we're willing to look at both sides of this devastating flow that's coming down. And the one side is that he actually does, he confesses this in a court as if people should be sympathetic with him. Well, surely you understand how guilty I felt when I let my half-Jewish cousin off and I let this Jewish couple go because my uncle wanted them to be free. You can understand how guilty I felt because I hadn't followed my orders, right? I mean, that's who I am. He's so sincere in his appeal that our response makes us say, what a hideous monster. Is not wrong. I mean, that's not a wrong emotional or even moral response. It's a, you know, the word for it is moral repugnance. That's what it creates in us. And that's an appropriate moral repugnance. At exactly the same moment, our less emotional, and I'm not condemning the emotional side. I think it's incredibly valuable for understanding what was going on wrong here. We should be irate reading these words from him. In that same moment, the other side of us, the side that can back up and analyze what's going on here, sort of the meta conscience that we have, should be able to say, he's got to be thinking fundamentally differently than I think. For him even to say that, to admit that publicly, I would never admit that that's the thing that I felt guilty about. I would be saying to the court, I feel guilty about what I've done to all of these Jews. But instead he feels guilty about the opposite. That part should wake us up and say, he must be thinking something fundamentally different from the way we think about things. And so that point, that recognition that something's gone wrong with his way of thinking about the world should make us realize that let me put it to you this way. If you grow up in Germany in 1932, you're a small child, you're a teenager even, and every role model that's put in front of you is telling you how important it is that we preserve the purity of the blah, blah, blah. Now, see, I'm just starting the sentence, and I know that you're already thinking, oh, don't give me that suddenly it's going to be okay. Of course it's not okay. That's the point of me saying at the beginning of this episode that we have to see two sides of this. First of all, how difficult it is for us to understand where our own morality has been corrupted by the way we've been inculcated in our culture to think about things. It's taken me 60 years to recognize the things that for the last 45 years, I just thought were the only way we ought to think about the world. Because it was the only way I had thought about the world, because it was the only world in which I'd lived. And I thank God, and I don't say that lightly, I mean him. I thank God for intervening to shake me out of my moral slumber, to, you know, use a side quote of Kant, and think about things differently. I don't just think about them saying, well, therefore, there's no morality. But I do think about it saying, man, I had a lot of weaknesses in my moral understanding that I needed to address. And if I can say that, then I recognize that I can never pretend that I've overcome all of those moral weaknesses in my understanding of the world. And just acknowledging that brings a moral humility to a human being. It couldn't not bring that moral humility to us. At the same time, that moral humility, this is what I said at the beginning of the episode. I'll repeat it again in a moment when we close. But at the beginning of the episode, I was saying we need to do two things. Create that moral humility, meaning recognize the frailty in our recognition of our own frailty. But then the second part of it is, if you have moral humility, it has to mean that something is telling you there's something wrong with you. Otherwise, you don't have any reason to be humble about your morality. Moral humility should be a sign that you're acknowledging a reality, an absolute, a moral truth, a fabric of the way God has made things. I think it has to be associated with Him no matter what, that you can't violate and that we don't have the perfect ability to acknowledge. So in the same breath where we're acknowledging our moral humility, wow, Eichmann really thought that. And he really had been inculcated with that in his culture to an extent that he still didn't see what was wrong while he was saying it in a Jewish courtroom. That we could acknowledge that we could be that corrupted doesn't mean we have to say, oh, and therefore we wash our hands of every trial. We can never point at anyone and say, you know, that was wrong. You shouldn't have done that. It doesn't mean that. It means that we back up and say, and now we have to acknowledge those more fundamental, those more foundational realities of truth and ethics, morality, that made us realize that humility that we have to have. Okay, so here are the thoughts that I want to give us to think about as we work our way toward the close of this in light of what I was talking about with Eichmann right there, right? Number one, if we act, so first of all, this is just universally true about us. I could spend the entire episode talking about this. I know, you think I'm about to. I could, but I'm going to try not to. We act as if we know more than we do. That's how we are as human beings. And proof, just open Twitter. I mean, for crying out loud, just open Twitter. And the very first thing you will see will be somebody acting like they know more than they do. And if you say, well, you know, you think you know everything. Well, you're right. I do the same thing, and I'm saying it about Twitter. So you're right. Maybe the first thing you open won't be that. And then you can say, even he thinks he knows more than he does. And then it'll just prove that I was right. And I'm still right. See, I do know more than I do. Just kidding. I mean, you get the irony in that, right? Hopefully. Okay, so anyway. So, for instance, when we, and this is me saying, we often act as if we know more than we actually know. So when Eichmann is in the trial, we judge him as if he's completely different from us because we act as if we understand exactly what was going on. And we create this narrative, this script that has him meeting in a dark room with someone and sharpening their fangs and deciding on the ways they're going to do this thing. And it is that evil, but it doesn't look that way in their heads or in their planning or in their defenses of it. So we act as if we know more than we do, for instance, when we're looking at other people and judging their motives. That doesn't mean what they're doing is right. But our judging of other people's motives is absurd. I can't even get inside my own head to figure out what on earth is going on in there. And that, I mean, that's why a lot of people, you know, recognize the value of counseling and therapy because we're not good at even reading ourselves. Why on earth do we think we're good at reading other people's motives? Why do we think we can look at someone else and determine what was going on in their heart of hearts? We can't even get outside of our own heart of hearts. And when we're in our own heart of hearts, we can't figure out what's going on in there. Okay, you got the idea. So hopefully we recognize our ignorance there. We recognize, I mean, I can't just judge other people like that. And I don't know historically what happened here or there about things that I don't have enough data about to say, well, sure enough, there was a World War II, you know, things like that. So I'm willing to admit my hermeneutical vulnerability, all of those things. I'm willing to acknowledge all those things. In that moment, hopefully, we recognize that ignorance, but are not content with it. We don't say, oh, well, I guess I'm just never going to know anything, you know? That's not the point here. The point is to grow, to do something better. So then what do we do when we grow? So when we grow from that point, now I'm recognizing my frailty. So I'm a little stronger because I at least acknowledge my frailty. Then how do I use that strength? So when we grow, hopefully, we realize that one of the things that's most important about our weaknesses is that it reveals that we're not different from the people we like to criticize. Now, believe me, I like to criticize people. But the hurtful thing about that is that I usually end up recognizing that I'm as bad or worse than the people I'm criticizing. And that's embarrassing. So I don't like that, but this is a reality. So, I mean, obviously we're different than other people. I know that. We have different gifts than other people. God puts churches together because different people have different gifts and he uses them in different ways to complete the whole body so we can reflect the full maturity and presence of Christ in the world. I love all of that. I think he does that with all of us. I think he does it in the economy. I think he does it with businesses. I think he does it bringing people together because individually we're not good enough alone. I love that. God makes differences in people. He makes every person different. In some ways, I'm not ignoring that. We have different competencies. We have different interests, different values sometimes. That's all fine. God makes us that way. I think we have different values sometimes because in our imperfection, we need each other to hone us together as a community or a society to be a better society than any of us would be by ourselves. All of that, I think, has value. So I'm not pretending like there are no differences, but in this idea that we can look at another person and say, oh, man, do they deserve judgment? Good grief, what is going on with them? And so in that sense, I'm saying we are the same as that person in this universal truth that God has given us gifts. He's given us a calling, that we have a purpose, whatever words you want to put on it, and we've not lived up to them. And we're all that way, all of us, 100%, no exceptions. I don't know. So I know some people who, no. I mean, this is the meaning of saying we're all sinners. It's not just we all go out and hunt down, you know, innocent animals and torture them to death. That's not what we mean when we say everybody's a sinner. Everybody tortures small animals. We mean everybody's fallen short of what God created them to be. So I'm sorry. My producer's lost it over there for some reason. So the example I'll give you of that is in 2 Corinthians 10, you know, when Paul says this. He's describing himself and them, the people that he's written this letter to, and he's written a critical letter to them, and he's following it up with more instructions about what they ought to be doing, and he knows that he has people there who are critical of him, and so he says, well, look at what's before your eyes. In other words, examine yourselves. Just look at each other, and you'll see this. If anyone is confident that he is Christ, then let him remind himself that just as he is Christ, so are we. These are the people who would criticize him. He's saying, well, look at yourselves. You say, oh, well, we're Christ. We belong to Christ. But that guy, Paul, why does he have a right to speak to us at all? And Paul says, because I'm just like you are. God gave me a calling. He gave you a calling. He gave all of us a calling. I'm called, you're called, we all called for ice cream, right? That's the idea. Okay, so anyway, he says, for even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I'll not be ashamed of it. I'm not going to hang my head about it. I don't want to appear to be frightening you with my letters. I know people say, ooh, he writes like he's big and heavy and strong, but when he's in person, he's weak and his speech is useless. But let that person understand this, that whatever I say to you by letter when I'm absent, that's exactly what I will say to you when I'm present with you in person. And it's not that I dare to classify, this is the important part, this is what I wanted to get to. You know, what he said so far is, don't go around there saying, oh, we're here and we're Christ, and this guy, he's just some stranger and he's nobody, he's just wrote a letter, just throw it away, it doesn't even mean anything. I belong to Christ just like you do. And he's not saying they don't belong to Christ just like he does. He's saying we have an equal standing here. And it doesn't mean we have the same gifts. He's rebuking them because they're wrong. He's willing to say they're wrong, but he doesn't say it because they're inhuman, they're machines, you idiots, you, what is wrong with you? He doesn't say that. He says, no, because we are all standing before God equally. I can still say to you what you need to hear in order to improve. But then he goes on to say it this way, so not that we dare classify or compare ourselves with some of those who are commending themselves. In other words, I'm not measuring myself against you to say, well, I'm just as big as you are. I'm just as important as you are. That would be making the mistake they're making because they do that. They compare themselves with Paul and they say, we're more important than you are. So if your measure of satisfaction about who you are is just that you measure up just as well as they do, then you haven't got the right measure in place. So he says, but when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they're without understanding. But we don't boast beyond our limits, beyond our standard. but instead boast only with regard to the area of influence God assigned to us. And that reaches even to you. See, it's a brilliant balancing back and forth of the two things I'm talking to you about right now, of him saying, I don't think I'm better than you. I just think I have a responsibility before God to speak to you. And you shouldn't think you're better than me. That doesn't mean you don't have anything I could learn. Maybe some of my communication was a little braggy. Yeah, maybe you're right. That's what he says in the letter. I'm not going to defend it. Maybe we did that. But it doesn't mean God didn't charge me with telling you this, nor that you shouldn't fix it. So yeah, we have equal standing, but don't measure yourself against me and say you're better than I am, and therefore you don't have to listen. Measure yourself against God and whether you're doing what he called you to do or not. And I'll measure myself against God and know whether I'm doing what he called me to do or not. And part of what he called me to do was tell you, you're not doing the right thing right now. So he didn't give up being able to say what was absolute or real because he acknowledged humbly that he was the same as the people who were around him. So hopefully, you know, what that means is we acknowledge the humanity and complexity of others' actions, which just drives people batty right now. I mean, I would love to spend the whole time just pulling up news stories about people who can't look at another person who disagrees with them without dehumanizing them. These monsters are destroying our society. That's the only way they can talk about it. They can't say, but why do they do that? You know, we did this a lot when we were talking about the sanctity of life issue a while back and saying we have to figure out how to hear the people who are on the pro-choice side, not saying, oh, you're right, abortion is fine, just go ahead. We don't have to say that, but we do have to learn to say a person's not a monster because they value women or the crises that women are facing sometimes that do affect them directly in different ways than they affect other people and so on. That's a different episode. You can go back and look it up. I'm sure Daisy will link to it somehow on the website. So anyway, okay, so I'm saying all of that to say hopefully we can learn to acknowledge the humanity and complexity of others' actions. We don't have to regard people as being barbaric or backwards because, and I will give a few examples. I mean, I'll just mention these briefly. We don't have to regard people as barbaric or backwards just because they celebrate differently than we do. I've heard people mock the celebrations that happen when there's a zagruta, you know, in Arab culture and Arab communities, when somebody's, you know what I'm talking about, an ululation or a, how do you say, when people are trilling with their tongues. Now, do you know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm, when people are celebrating other people, like it's like, oh, what kind of, you know, so they have a different way of celebrating. I mean, if in some places people clap because they agree with a sermon point, in other places people say amen, who gives a rip? I mean, just it's okay. We don't have to say, oh, what a moral compromise they've made. So people aren't barbaric or backwards because they celebrate differently or because they speak a different language. You know how we raise our voice at somebody who speaks English as a second language and it's like, do you understand me? And as if there's something wrong with their intellect. And they're the ones who are able to speak more languages than you're able to speak or than most of us are able to speak. Or because they eat other foods. They eat horse meat. They eat dog. You got to be kidding. I'm not in favor of eating dogs. I don't want you to eat your dog. I don't want to eat a dog. I'm just saying I'm not going to condemn a culture because they happen to eat a dog. I'm not in favor of it either, by the way. But anyway, the point is you don't have to condemn them for it. So I'm sorry. My producer's losing it again. So it's not my fault. Okay, so let me wrap it up. As we're acknowledging those complexities and we treat others with dignity, we start saying, oh, no, this is a person who thinks about the world differently than we do. We can also maintain our commitment to the ultimate values that lie underneath, that underpin our purpose in life here, which is, by the way, loving and serving people. It's not a complicated purpose in life. Jesus made it pretty direct, right? This is your great commandment. And so in Immanuel Kant, that comes to the point of the categorical imperative. You have to treat other people with the same respect that you give to yourself. You have to love others like you love yourself. And this is what comes up in Eichmann's trial. And as Arendt says it in that chapter I was talking about, I'm quoting Arendt now, And she'll quote him. I mean, we have a translation of it. And to the surprise of everybody, Eichmann came up with an approximately correct definition of the categorical imperative. But listen to this. I'm going to prepare you how to listen to this quotation. And I don't mean shape the quotation for you. I just want you to notice it. That she acknowledges the intelligence that he has and his ability to summarize the categorical imperative from Kant, the golden rule, essentially. And then in the same moment, while she's saying, look, this man was sincere in what he was saying, in the same moment, in a simple paragraph, she completely undermines his argument and makes the point that he still ought to be condemned, even if that's what he understood it to mean. And so to the surprise of everyone, as I read her, she says, Eichmann came up with an approximately correct definition of the categorical imperative. I mean by my, this is Eichmann now, she's quoting Eichmann, I meant by my remark about Kant that the principle of my will must always be such that it can become the principle of general laws. And then Arendt has in parentheses, to completely undermine what he said, which is not the case, by the way, with theft or murder, for instance, because the thief or the murderer cannot conceivably wish to live under a legal system that would give others the right to rob or murder him. It's obvious that it was self-contradictory, and she does that. She is acknowledging his humanity for the point of teaching us to be humble, but also acknowledging the superior morality that condemns him. And she doesn't have to dehumanize him to do that, and in fact, the only way morality keeps its footing is if we remember that what it applies to is human beings who are still human while they're violating it. In the example, I gave the example of Kant just then, in the example of Judge Landau, the quotation I read to you earlier from what this man I don't know, Dr. Wechtenbruck, had said, when he told reporters that Eichmann had great confidence in Judge Landau, I won't read the whole thing to you again. And so Eichmann thinks, oh, well, he'll be able to resolve the thing. Surely we'll come down with a peaceable resolution to this matter. And then when he ends up condemned, he's mystified. He's disappointed because he had mistaken humanity, which Landau did provide for him, with softness, which Landau did not provide for him. And that's the ideal that I'm advocating for, that we practice the humanity that God has given us, but that we not give up the reality, the truth, that he's given us as a foundation to build on so that that humanity can do what it's called to do, loving and serving. So all I'm saying is this, we really can be peacemakers. So in the beginning, I had said to you, the frailty is partially what we bring to our own frailty, that we don't recognize in ourselves the frailties that are so obvious in others. But that when we do, I said also this, that when we do recognize the frailty in ourselves, rather than abandoning the strength and the gift and the power that God has allowed us, that God has given us to allow us to see that frailty, we ought to hang on to that. And so because we give that up, because we give up that strength or gift or power, we lose half of what it means to be peacemakers. So what I'm saying to you is we really can pursue truth and righteousness through mercy and reconciliation.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.